Okay, as I said, Achron Chaviv, Rabbi Dr. Ari Sitner, who is also a professor at Wurzweiler in New York. He has special deals and relationships with couples, and that's where we're going to end the our program dealing with relationships and during this difficult time. And it's a pleasure to welcome you, Bakasha, Rabbi Doctor.
Amazing, thank you. I'm so honored to be here amongst colleagues and friends, and thank you all for being here. So, you know, relationships, shalom bayis, you know, the marriage, the home, it's really the seed of everything. And there's so much to be said. So I'm going to really try to encapsulate a number of points and hopefully some practical takeaways as well. I'll tell you that as a couples therapist, every day I'm watching couples repair their relationships and learn new ways of techniques and communication, understanding each other. And I hear people say, wow, now I really understand what people mean when they say like marriage takes hard work. And when they say that, most of the time, it's really under normal circumstances, the best of circumstances. It is hard. It takes work. And that's something to all keep in mind, right? It's, you know, it's not just like you get in the car, you go. We take that for granted. It takes work. And really, and if we can, I'll just make sure that we're muted, please.
If anybody talks, I'll mute them. That was just, it sometimes takes me half a second to get to mute them, but yes.
Perfect. Thank you. So anyway, that's under normal circumstance. When we live now under what I can only describe as extraordinary times, really times of a crisis, it really ramps up the pressure. And we hear a lot about trauma. We're talking about trauma and the reality of trauma is that really when we talk about healing trauma, trauma is in the past. Right. Person was, God forbid, in a fire. The flames are out. Now we talk about dealing with all of the emotional dysregulation, hypervigilance effects of that. But we're really living in a state right now where the flames are still burning, right? Where they're still hostages to be saved and rescued. And there's still rockets and sirens. And it's active. It's alive. It's with us. And so that makes the level of crisis that we're in that much more difficult. So what happens in a relationship when we have these types of situations? In other words, the backdrop of regular, you know, on a good day, marriage is hard, right? Regular stress of life makes it even harder, but this is really particularly complicated. And when people ask me, okay, what's the secret to a good relationship? I'll often turn it around to them and ask what they think. And the number one answer I tend to hear from people is communication, right? Good communication. And really, I think it's a myth. It's something that we're led to believe. Communication is not what it's about. Really, a good marriage is about friendship, right? There's the number keeps going up, 6, 7, 8 billion people on the planet. But you know, there's one single human being that I walk the journey of life with, and that person has my back and I have their back. That's the friendship. And we have to also put an emphasis on communications. Why? Because communication is the key that unlocks the relationship. In other words, if you look at the real value of a friendship, you can be vulnerable. You can be open. You can be raw with another human being. And that's what emotions want, to be vulnerable, to be tender. And what we tend to do is we often keep it locked up. We keep it kind of behind closed doors. We don't like to open up our emotions. When the communication is really safe and gentle and kind and comfortable, we open up. When it's not, the communication says, hey, this isn't safe. You better lock it down. One of my mentors, my Rebbe, if you will, in relationships is Dr. John Gottman, and he's claimed to fame as a marriage relationship researcher and an expert is that he can watch a couple have a 3-minute argument and predict with 94% accuracy whether that couple is going to stay together or get divorced. So he's holding, as they say. And one of the fascinating findings that I'll often teach couples from his research is that if you look at the opening line that a couple uses in a conversation, the opening line 96% of the time correlates with how the conversation concludes. In other words, if my wife comes to me and says, we need to talk, or I walk in late and she goes, where were you? That opening line is going to predict it ain't going to go well. But if she starts off with, hey, it's so nice to see you. I'm so glad that you're home, comma, you know, I was really stressed that you weren't here. I didn't know where you were, right? We can have that conversation, but the opening line really predicts what's going to happen. And that's really important because that shows us that good communication disarms. It opens up. It invites a sense of vulnerability, right? Kemayim panim upanim, panim, ken lev adam, right? That we're able to open up because we feel that sense of reciprocity that comes along with a safe emotional form of communication. In fact, one of my favorite psukim in the Torah is if you look through Sefer Bereishis and you find, okay, where is the first conversation that we have recorded in the Torah where a husband and wife talk to each other? Right? We don't find it by Adam and Chava. We don't find it by Noah. We're fast forwarding. It's in Parshas Lech Lecha. You're talking 2,000 years into the story of humanity. And Avram Avinu turns to his wife and says, Hinei no yadati ki isha yifas mara'at. He looks at her and says, wow, honey, you're beautiful. It's amazing that towards the very first conversation is a husband telling his wife that she looks nice. Right? And again, there's a stressful background, a lot going on, going to Mitzrayim, but we can open up with something disarming. We can show that gentle conversation penetrates the heart. And so communication is not the goal. Communication is simply the key that lets us access the friendship. So when I work with couples every day, I teach them the techniques and the skills that the research shows. If you talk this way, it'll go well. If you talk that way, it won't go well. And a lot of couples take it and they run with it. Great. The research is time tested and it's proven and it's ironclad. So great. If it works, just do it. And then something else interesting tends to happen, which is I'm teaching the couples the research, the techniques of the best practices for how to communicate with each other. And suddenly you start seeing some couples just aren't doing it. Now, they're putting in a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort and energy and emotion to come to couples therapy, and yet they're learning techniques, but they're not practicing them. And if you're not a good couples therapist, you're not well trained, you're just going to get frustrated with them. But if you really know what's going on, you can look more closely. And you say, these couples, it's not that they won't do it. You realize that it's that they can't do it. There's a block. There's something stopping them. And what's that block? Where is it that they need the help? So this is where trauma comes in. Because the trauma often is the block that's saying they have been through something in their life that makes this really uncomfortable to do. And the reality is we all have our stuff. We all have our stuff. So I kind of think of it this way. A couple comes to see me and they're usually, you know, pretty frustrated the last number of years. The research shows an average couple waits about 6 years of suffering before they decide to pick up the phone and schedule couples therapy. So that means they've been in a pretty miserable state for a while. So I help couples understand that those years of struggling kind of did some damage. There's trauma in the marriage. But where we're starting, this isn't the beginning. We really have to go back to the first 5, 10, 15, 20 years of their lives, because it's in that part before they ever met each other, where things happen in life, right? Where there's, you know, abuse, neglect, trauma, damage, just different experiences that the inner young child learns. And then when we experience those things, the brain has to come up with ways to cope. We then go into marriage carrying those burdens. And we don't always know that we're carrying those burdens. And so we enter a marriage carrying stuff. We then have a hard time connecting or kind of putting our guard down, opening that locked door of emotions to one another. So now we have what I call chapter one damage from the trauma of childhood. We have chapter two damage, things we did in marriage to kind of hurt each other. Maybe not intentionally, but it happens. And now we're starting chapter three, right? And chapter three is where we kind of incorporate the healing of both. And what I love about watching couples who work on their Shalom Bayis is that it not only brings connection and safety, it doesn't only trickle down to the children and the whole feel of the home, but it actually has an incredible power to heal a lot of the childhood wounds and traumas that they had. So the early research on attachment theory, John Bowlby, Mary Ainsley, they talk about the sort of this picture where a baby is born, baby's helpless. If completely left alone, the baby will not survive. When we think about in the animal world, it's amazing. Animal is born, a minute later it gets up and it's walking around and it can, like, it's animals can survive. A baby can't change itself, can't feed itself, can't regulate its body temperature. It is completely helpless. And so the baby knows that there's a vulnerability. I am unsafe. I can't survive without somebody there, a caretaker, to help me. And that's where we form attachments. And when a child has a wonderful, secure upbringing, present parents, physically, emotionally, stability, they grow up feeling a sense of security, emotional security. And if, let's say, a spouse comes home late and doesn't call, they're not dysregulated. They're not thrown off. It happens, right? Life has stress. Things happen. But let's say that same child grew up in a home where there's a lot of disruption. Maybe the family moved a lot. Maybe the parents worked late, traveled, they had a whole bunch of different caregivers. That little baby is looking to say, one second, who do I count on here? And if it's there isn't a sense of stability and security, that child could develop more of an anxious or an avoidant attachment style, kind of like, I don't really know who I can count on here. And as a result, gets much more uncomfortable with those things that tend to happen in a marriage. In other words, a spouse who comes home late might turn into a big fight because it feels so much more painful. So that's a really perfect example of where that chapter one, earlier stuff before we ever met, are things I carry. I bring that into marriage. And then the fights we're having now really are rooted in things that may have started 20, 30, 40, 50 years earlier. There's a fascinating a study that, and you can actually look on YouTube. It's you can see it. It's amazing, by Dr. Ed Tronick, called the Still Face Experiment. And essentially, what happens in this still face experiment is you've got a mother and a little toddler. Toddler sitting in a high chair, and the mother is playing and talking to the toddler, and they're interacting, and it's adorable. And then the scientists, the researchers, tell the mom, just have a still face, just completely show no emotion or reaction to what your child is doing. And it's unbelievable what then happens. That little baby starts pointing and the mother doesn't react. The baby starts making faces. The baby starts screaming, crying, arching her back, like just looking for something. And you see trying everything. After a minute or two, the mother then picks up the kid and everything is now fine. But for that minute or so where the baby is trying to do everything it can to get the attention of the caregiver, of the mom, you see that sense of dysregulation. Now, I will often show that video to couples, and it's fascinating. Sometimes you'll have a wife sitting there and she's kind of like, well, that was cute. And then she'll turn to her husband and he's grabbing the tissues and he's mopping his face and he's crying. He goes, oh my God, that poor baby. That's so terrible. It's so horrible. I can't believe that they would do that. That kid. And when we start to see that reaction, different reaction to the husband or wife, we start to see a little taste of some of the attachment styles of what we really need when life gets tough. That sense of friendship of, are you there for me? Can I count on you? Is everything. It's what makes the difference. It's what that inner child really is looking for. And the more stressful life gets, and again, as we're talking about now, extraordinary times, the research is really clear that that makes it that much more difficult to put our walls down because the brain wants to go into more of a fight or flight, more of a protective state. And I just feel like I need my partner to be there for me. I'll give you a quick, like a case study, a quick example. Let's say you have a couple where they're married a couple of months and the wife shows up to therapy and says something like, my husband doesn't care about me. He comes home and he ignores me and I'm crying to him to give me attention. What does he do? He walks away. Right. So you listen to that. Like, this is Shona Rishona. Come on. Like you want to shake the guy. You want to be like, come on, show up for your wife. So all of that is very like, it's heartbreaking to hear, but maybe that's only half the story. So imagine for a second if in her chapter one, let's say the wife was on a raise in a home where her father traveled for work every week and she had a lot of different siblings. And let's throw in there that she was the middle child and her mother overwhelmed, juggling a lot, lots going on. Maybe the mother was stressed, maybe depressed, a lot of burden, a lot of responsibility. So as a result of that upbringing, all this inner child needed when she got married was, oh, I just want to feel like that sense of calm, of stability. Someone is there for me. And so when the husband seemed just a little bit distant to her, it escalated even more than it would for anybody else. All she wants to do is to feel loved. Now everybody wants to feel loved, but her chapter one was informing that the external stresses of her context, what was happening in the background, is making its way into the marriage. So when the husband walks in the door and, look, everyone's allowed to, take some time to relax, but he didn't necessarily appreciate what she was carrying. And all he saw was she's always screaming. She's always crying. I don't know how to make her happy. And he wants to make her happy, just doesn't know how to do it. But when he comes in the door, imagine if option A, he just sees her like, bolting toward him and he's like, wow, right? Maybe in his childhood, he was smothered. Maybe he needs a little space, right? So maybe he just pulls away and leaves her upset. Or option B, what if he were to just communicate? And that's the magic, just to communicate. Just to be able to understand with compassion what she carries, where she comes from, and she's not a bad person. Right? Honey, I want to spend some time with you. I'm going to give you a hug. Can I take 5, 10, 20 minutes and just go crash on the couch? And then I'd love to spend some time to speak to her chapter one, to speak to the trauma that might be informing why she's struggling. Right? It's a, otherwise a beautiful relationship. But what starts to happen is we start to feel pain and stress. We feel it physically in our body. People are always reporting how they feel it, like in their neck and their chest and their shoulders and their stomach. It really hurts. It really hurts. When you love someone, you want them, they're not there for you. And in life, when we're struggling just as a self, an individual, right? We're all just trying to like keep ourselves afloat. And then what happens if I look over to you and I see you're the problem? You're the one who's rocking my boat. You're the one who's causing the issues. So Dr. Sue Johnson calls it, find the bad guy. We start playing this game of like who we can point to and say, you're the problem and you need to change and you need therapy and you're the issue. And honestly, in the history of relationships, no one ever got closer to someone because somebody told them all their flaws. So that feeling is a longing. And yet a longing can sometimes, if not communicated properly, a longing can actually be framed as an attack, right? And that's why that idea of starting off nicely, right? I'm so happy to see you. I'm so happy you're home. Takes the wall down. Kamayim panim al panim. I was once at a wedding with a French actor who was Masader Kedushin, and he shared that it's interesting when the husband takes the ring and he puts it on the Kala's finger, right? Put on the pointer finger, right? It's really strange because no one wears it on the pointer finger, right? Everyone takes it out later and they put it on the ring finger, right? Hence the name, the ring finger. So he says, what's the point of using the pointer finger? And he gave a beautiful explanation and he says, because we want to be able to take the finger and want to point it up to Hashem and say, Hashem, this union is so divinely perfectly coordinating that we have to be able to point to say, Meis Hashem Ha'isazos, this came from God. This shidduch, right, is divine. And I really loved that explanation, really resonated with me. And then I started thinking about some of this research and it gave me another perspective, right? And maybe not one that we should say under the chuppah, but why the ring finger, right? Because when we enter the marriage, if people are pointing fingers at each other and saying, you're the problem, right? You need to change. You need to go to therapy. You have to stop everything you're doing wrong, that the marriage doesn't work, right? All that blaming, all that does is push the other person away. So when we're standing under the chuppah, right? First thing we do is she points a finger at him, right? A symbol that looks like it's saying you against me, right? But what's his response when she's pointing a finger? He says, let's put a round circle, an infinite loop. The circle just says one word, we. That's what the circle says, right? There's no beginning. There's no end. It's a we. So let's take that concept of one of us might blame the other. We're going to respond with the we, right? By having that sense of connection. And that's what a happy couple, right, is going to really focus on in building their sense of shalom bias. Dr. Julie Gottman, who's the other half of Dr. John Gottman in their work. In fact, I'll just make a quick recommendation here. I just got their new book just came out called Fight Right, John and Julie Gottman. So it's an excellent book talking really about how couples can improve their communication and their styles of conflict. But she gives a mashal when talking about trauma. And she says, imagine if you have a person who's walking with a huge, big, heavy pot and it's filled with boiling water. It's my burden. I'm carrying the pot. It's not yours. It's mine. But what happens if every time you try to be supportive, you're standing next to me and I take a step and the water is filled to the top and it splashes over. I get burned and I cry and I'm hurting because carrying my burden, my peccal in life, my trauma, it burns me. It hurts me. But you know what's going to happen every time you try to get close to me and I splash water? You're going to get burned. You're going to get wet. And then suddenly over time, that other person, the partner starts to drift away because they say, I can't keep getting burned by your problems. And then they start doing the blaming. You need to work on you. You need to fix your trauma. And really the solution is for each person to take one of the handles of the pot and say, can we carry this together? Right? Again, going back to that concept of we, right? The we is what solves the issue. Another fascinating tool that really helps couples when they're dealing with that pressure of the stress, the trauma is to, before we point a finger, before we say, you need to do the work, let me ask myself, what am I doing? Can I do more? Can I take more responsibility for the relationship? And most people don't think of that first. They tend to think of what they're, no one ever comes to therapy to me and say, I'd like to explore what I could do better to be a better spouse. It's usually, let me tell you what my partner's doing wrong so that they could be better. If you could fix them, that would be great. So one of the fascinating things is something called self-talk. In other words, to look at your own narrative. Instead of blaming the other person, can I look at what I am doing? And the research on this, on what Gottman calls fondness and admiration, right? People have to tell each other often, daily, I love you. I care about you. In fact, successful couples have a ratio of 20 to 1 where on a daily basis. They're saying nice things to each other. They're interacting positively. So 20 positive for every one negative. And think of like an emotional bank account. I fill it up. And if I make a withdrawal, there's plenty left over, right? But if I'm in the negative, if I'm in the red, the relationship is going to hurt. And I tell couples the first thing you ever look at, if you're ever feeling things are getting a little bit what I call crunchy in the relationship, it's feeling cold, tense, distant, ask yourself if you've been filling up the emotional bank account to be kind, to be caring, to with smiles and touch and warmth and presence to be there for the other person. So imagine the following scenario, though, in terms of self-talk, not just what I can do for you. Let's say I'm getting into bed and I say to my wife, something I wanted to share with you. Great. And as I turn to her in bed, she's out cold sleeping. I'm at an intersection now where I can do one of two things. Option A, I can look at her sleeping and I can say to myself, right, oh my God, I can't believe she just passed out like that and she's just snoring like a bear and just completely doesn't care about anybody else. And if I say that to myself, I go to sleep, wake up in the morning, and she's going to say, hi, good morning. And I'm going to say, don't good morning me, right? Because I'm zerbitter. I'm upset. Now, what happened between when we went to sleep and woke up? We never talked. This is all inside of me. Option B, fall asleep and I look at her and I say to myself, oh, Hashem protect her when she's sleeping. God bless her. She works so hard. She's so tired. She passed out. She's so exhausted. I love her. She should sleep well. We'll talk in the morning. So then next thing, fast forward, she wakes up in the morning, says, good morning. And I'm going to smile and say, good morning. Hope you slept well. You owe me a conversation. I want to talk with you still. Oh my gosh, I feel so bad. I fell asleep. And we come together with a sense of connection. What changed between those two options where things went badly or things went well? The only nafkamina, the difference was what I told myself, not about what I said to her. I didn't say a word. There's no communication going on in the marriage. It's simply what I say to myself. So we all have an opportunity to look internally, to be able to say, what can I say to myself rather than look at the other person? And the last thing I want to say, and then maybe we'll just open it up to 2-3 minutes of questions if we have time for that, is things in life don't always go according to plan. Maybe somebody had the great strength to pick up and to move to Israel. They made Aliyah. And they get there and a war breaks out and they say, you know, this is not what I signed up for. Right? This isn't what I expected. Maybe somebody marries someone who didn't know they had all that chapter one stuff. Maybe they didn't know themselves. And now I'm left dealing with a spouse who has this issue and that issue and this trauma. Right? And sometimes being in a state of crisis brings up old stuff. We don't know why we're reacting strongly, but it's chapter one. And a person can get really frustrated. This isn't what I signed up for. And it's understandable that there's frustration. It's understandable to feel those emotions. And part of what the Mary Kubler-Ross's model of the five stages of grief talks about, when we confront loss, we have to go through stages, right? So one of those stages is the denial. I can't believe it. I'm shocked. This doesn't make sense. I could be angry. I can be bargaining. I could be depressed till I get to acceptance. There's a lot of emotions that a person could cycle through. And it's not easy. It's not easy. And then we turn to the very beginning of the Torah. We look at the opening of Bereishis, and something very strange happens. Hashem intends for Adam and Chava, puts him in Gan Eden, and the goal is, hey, stay in Gan Eden. Everything should be great. And then someone said, oops, 1 second, wait, change of plans, they're kicked out. And Hashem wanted that the eats should taste like the fruit. Oh, but okay, in the end, we're do away with that. And then the sun and the moon, well, they're both supposed to be big in the same sun. But then there's a fight. No, we reduce it, right? The moon gets smaller. And Hashem wants the world to be great in Parshas Noach, and then suddenly there's a whole flood, right? And then we leave Mitzrayim, and we get the luchos, oh, then the egel, the second luchos. Okay, it's supposed to go straight to Eretz Yisrael. No, in Meraglim, and we spend 40 years. What's all of this? It's supposed to go this way, plan A, and then instead it has to turn to plan B. Right? Well, Hashem is Hashem. If Hashem wants to just say, like, this is how it's going to be, then make it happen. Give us the actual version. Don't give us all the we were supposed to. And Rav Reisman, quoting Rav Pamzatzal, says something incredible. He says, perhaps from the very beginning of Bereishis that Hashem is modeling for us, that the way that the world works is that things are not going to go according to plan. And to embrace that, not to resist it. In other words, to lean into the fact that we are constantly having to pivot. That's been our story in Gullis for 2,000 years, a lot of pivoting. And we can choose. We have a choice. What's the narrative we tell ourselves? Do we want to be angry and resentful? Right? Or we can abandon all of the shoulds and just say, okay, this is how life is supposed to work. It's okay. It's not going to always go according to plan. And if we can change that inner narrative and use our emuna as a jumping off point to say, I can pivot that, you know, my marriage, maybe my spouse, things are in my, or my children, my home. It's not exactly how I ever planned it. And can I say that's the way it's supposed to go? If I can tell that to myself, I can make peace with that. I could use that as a source of strength and then use that strength to be able to relate in that kind, gentle, loving way to everyone around me. Okay. So, Mirza Shem, we should all have a tremendous siyata d'shmaya and in our shalom bias and in all that we're doing. So I'll stop here and see if we have any time for questions.
All right, you can unmute yourself if anyone wants to ask any questions. While we wait for that, maybe how have you seen the war sort of impact? I mean, I know it's 4 months is not that long, I guess, from this point of view, but how long, I mean, unfortunately, it's too long, but how have you seen it impacting our relationships?
So I think we got a good view in COVID, in being able to see how couples in a longer stress of crisis have, gets impacted. Some couples got a lot stronger. Some couples will come to me and they'll be like, feel guilty saying, I hate to say that during COVID, we actually got a lot closer, right? But that's okay. And then you have couples who it strained them. And I think with the war, it's the same thing. You have some couples who were predisposed to stress and the stress only exacerbates the difficulties in the relationship. And other couples, they find more meaning. They find more opportunities to connect on deeper levels because they're forcing themselves spiritually to connect to their people, to Hashem, to the matzav as we're all experiencing it.
And Asher, you want to ask a question?
Not really. I'd like to add something. Thank you for your insightful talk. I just wanted to add, when you point the finger at somebody, the other three fingers point back at you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Love that.
Okay. If nobody has any questions, we'll call it a day. 2 o'clock, it's been really a very, very powerful day for me, and I'm sure for all of you, and especially perhaps those living in Israel, even more so. And I really want to thank, I know many of the speakers were actually on much of the day, and I really want to thank everybody. And Michael and Marcia, I want to thank you again for your support, and I hope you found it as meaningful as everybody else did, as we all did. And really thank you to everybody. As I mentioned, the recording should be up within a couple days. And please join us for one of our many other classes that we have during the week. And everybody should be well. We should be stronger individually, collectively as a people. And we should hear good news and come together for happy occasions. And this should be all theoretical and not as practical as it may need to be sometimes. And thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful day. And Rabbi Sittner, thank you again. And thank you to everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. Erev Tov, Laila Tov, Tzaraim Tovim. Maybe Boker Tov if you're in Hawaii or in California, it's still Boker Tov. So those from California, Boker Tov. Okay. And there's Laila Tov. And thank you, everybody. Okay.